Dr. Julian Bashir, Chief Medical Officer, Deep Space Nine. And you are Commander...
Data.
Commander Data. The synthetic life form.
Yes.
It's an honor to meet you, sir. I've heard so much about you. You must have a fascinating perspective into bio-cybernetic research. I'd be delighted if we could discuss the subject sometime.
I would be happy to do so. However, I must ask you to stop your experiment.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, feeling like Urkel that time that he showed up on Full House.
Didn't I do that?
Well, Cameron, why do I feel like Urkel this week?
Because we are going to talk about the best and worst Star Trek crossovers.
Okay, but we have a very strict definition.
In which
you and I couldn't even quite decide on what constitutes a crossover episode. So we are going to get a lot of hate mail, perhaps.
Sure. More than usual.
Yeah, more than usual. So what we've done is kind of defined it as... an adventure with the crew that takes place within the contemporary context of these respective crews. So there's going to be some episodes, and maybe I'll just spoil one that we're going to leave to the end, but I think an episode like Relics or Sarek, you know, those ones where we have these old TOS era characters come back onto TNG, those don't necessarily constitute what we are going to define as crossover episodes. These have to take place within the contemporary context of the adventures at hand.
So what is it that eliminates these to you?
Well, it's not a genuine crossover episode because of that lack of contemporary context, though. It's more like a one-off adventure with somebody whose time has passed, whose story has already concluded at this point.
Has it really, though?
It has. Well, yeah, I mean, you could...
Scotty's been stuck in that Dyson.
But you know what? It's not a crossover episode.
Right.
Because...
The Scotty one, I feel, maybe comes closer, though, in that, to me, when I think crossover, a lot of it is about mashing up the aesthetics of the two properties. And when you have Picard on the original bridge, and you're paying off the history of a long-established character from a previous series... I don't know. That's where it gets a little fuzzy for me.
And I totally buy into that argument. But then I realized, oh, man, then we're going to have to open up the door to episodes like In a Mirror Darkly Part 2.
Right.
Because you can make that argument there. And I'm like, okay, well, then that's going to open the door to remember that Mirror episode where Mirror Tuvok appeared on Deep Space Nine?
It's my favorite episode.
Well, I know. So I think that was Through the Looking Glass. But I just realized there's going to be all these other doors that you have to go through.
I should have known that. It's my favorite episode.
Of course, yeah. Yeah. So I figured, you know, Cam, you and I, we got to hammer it down, figure out what exactly is going to be the definition here, or otherwise there's a big long list of things. So why don't we get into it?
And maybe we should just say that maybe in the future we'll do an episode on, like, character cameos, which will cover some of the ones that maybe people would like to hear about, but don't quite fit into what we're defining as a crossover.
There are so many opportunities in Star Trek.
Yeah.
Cam, we did comedy episodes in the past.
Sure. And like, you know what? People can also go back, way back to our archives, and look up our fan service moments episode. There's a lot of stuff in there that kind of fall outside of what we're defining as a crossover, but there's a lot of discussion about episodes there that I think people might like to hear about.
So why don't we start with one of the first ones that I think really epitomizes what we're tackling here, and that's the premiere of Deep Space Nine, Emissary, in which pretty much the opening sequence takes place with Locutus of Borg shooting his laser beam eye at the crew of the Saratoga, which, of course, Ben Sisko is serving aboard on. So this really sets up kind of what we think of as a contemporary context of the adventures of the crew going forward here. And I think what we want to do as we go on through these adventures, Cam, is talk about whether they justify themselves as crossover episodes or more like kind of cheap excuses to insert characters in for no particular reason other than just marketing.
Right.
So let's talk about Emissary and the entanglement between Sisko and Picard, where they set up a lot of conflict within, I guess, like when Picard is passing the torch on to Ben Sisko. And I know that this introduction did not do Ben Sisko many favors for a lot of fans for a long, long time.
Right. And this sort of follows in the tradition of the McCoy baton pass off in an Encounter at Farpoint, but in a way that, like, that one is totally a character cameo in that McCoy's contributing nothing to the story. It's just like, hey, guys, it's
but
me.
It also takes place about 100 years afterwards. And so it's not like a crossover episode because there's no mixing and mingling of, I guess, their contemporary adventures, right?
Right. But in this case, yeah, like, so we see Picard really engaging in this battle of wills against, you know, Sisko. And was this a smart way to start the series?
So I would say that I can go back and watch this series and think it's actually a pretty fantastic conflict.
In retrospect, yeah.
But at the time, I don't think it is because you're kind of poisoning the well for viewers. You're taking a revered main character and really putting him through the ringer from some nobody that nobody's ever heard of, nobody's really tied into, doesn't have any connections to. You know, and then you kind of get used to Sisko over the years. But at the time, you're like, whoa, I don't like this dude.
Like, imagine you'd had this similar, you know, a scene like this, maybe not in the exact same time period, but later down the road during, like, the Dominion War.
I think this would have been an even more fantastic
Would have really been the fireworks you're kind of looking for. But coming off of a first episode, it feels like Picard kind of punching down just because of the fact we don't know who Sisko is.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, who is it? He's supposed to be the lead. We don't really know anything about him other than his wife just died. And now Picard is like yelling at him.
But is the problem that it's Picard punching down or that Sisko,
from the point of view of the viewer?
No, but Sisko seems to be punching up at a very revered character. And you're like, who does this guy think he is?
Right.
I mean, yes, a widower who has every right to be quite upset with this man that he blames for his wife's death, of
course. Does it make Picard look like a bit of a jerk?
It does, yeah. And I totally buy that. And yeah, I can go back and watch this episode and be like, yeah, Picard doesn't actually come off all that great here. He's kind of like, hey, you know what? I rolled in the mud with my brother. I'm kind of over this, Sisko. So like, just lay off, bro.
Go find a mud puddle of your own.
Sisko had a sister.
Did we see her on the show?
No, she lived in Portland. I don't think they ever did any mud wrestling or anything like that back in Nollins or...
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah. So maybe let's talk a little bit about the aesthetics of this because we also have the Enterprise docked on Deep Space Nine.
I always love that.
Well, and it's in orbit of Bajor as well, which we only really got to see during that episode as well as the Mirror Universe crossover episodes.
Sure.
So, I mean, I think, like you said, like it's just a wonderful aesthetic to look at and it makes you feel as if this is like a large universe, which is totally worth it, you know, being engaged with here. For you, does Emissary justify itself as a crossover camp?
Emissary does. For me, what makes it work is that it establishes right off the bat that, like, Avery Brooks' Sisko is a character who's very passionate and has a lot of intensity to him. And you get to see sort of through this conflict with Picard, which, you know, as I said, I don't know if it was the smartest way to introduce your, you know, lead character in retrospect. But, you know, looking at it years later, it's a really interesting way to define Sisko's approach to the job versus Picard's.
Yeah.
It's just the question of in 1993 or four, was it four?
93.
Okay. Yeah. Like, was this a smart way to introduce a captain after the beloved Picard? Probably not.
But it's funny that we debate that because we like this episode in retrospect.
I really do. Yeah.
So it's funny how I think the writers had the right idea. It's just you wonder about the execution to a certain degree here. So
because a lot of people were, I think, on the fence about it. You know, like TNG was so hugely popular. And so they're excited for another series.
Yeah.
And the first thing they see is they're probably the most beloved character on the show squabbling with the lead of this show. It's like, well, why would I want to watch this guy?
It'd be like if there's a spinoff of Discovery and it starts with people laughing at Burnham for being thrown in jail as a mutineer. It's like, I don't know if that's...
Or if Pulaski had been spun off into her own show after the episode where she squabbles with Data.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, who wants to follow that character?
Yeah. So coming right off of that, I think the one that makes most sense to jump into would be Birthright Part 1, in which we have, well, it starts off with, of course, the crew on Deep Space Nine. They don't really enjoy the food and the replomats, but then it kind of carries over from there, and it's more of a kind of a Bashir crossover episode, in which he's interacting with Data. This is actually supposed to be Dax as a science officer interacting with Data, but they recruited Bashir. And this is
really, really well thought out.
Well, okay, so let's get into this because I actually do like this story in which Data's exploring dreams and what his own, I guess, parentage is under Dr. Seung. But I wonder if Bashir is the best fit for it. And I think the fact that they wanted Dax on it initially kind of indicates what my answer is, and that's no, probably not. What are your feelings about Bashir in this universe aboard the Enterprise D?
I'll tell you why I like it. And the reason I like Bashir being on this episode is because he feels like the least likely character to inject onto TNG to try and hype up
yeah.
Deep Space Nine.
The marketing campaign.
Yeah, look, it just seems so wacky to me.
Well, look at who you could have had, right? You could have had Kira. You could have had Quark.
You could have rewritten it and had it like a Worf Odo story.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things you could have done. I mean, why not O'Brien?
Because we had 177 episodes of him prior to that, Cam.
But it just seems like a fun way to do it, too, to have O'Brien in there again. I don't know. It just... In an ocean of possibilities, Bashir is such a weird one that I support it 100%.
I think the only better option would have been Jake Sisko.
Yeah.
That would have been him hanging out with Alexander.
Oh my God.
That
get out of my head, Tyler.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a bit of a wacky choice, but I think it kind of redeems itself by the fact that I very much like this Data storyline that we see. You and I were not big fans of the Worf story throughout
right.
Birthright parts 1 and 2.
Yeah.
But we both agree that this Data storyline is pretty strong here. And I think it's not bad that you have Bashir involved. You kind of set up the character at a time where I don't even think the actor quite knew what the character was supposed to be. So it makes it maybe not stand up as strong in retrospect versus Emissary, but it's still a fun adventure.
I do wonder, you know, how fans felt about this at the time. I don't know if you have any memories, because Bashir was not a character who had a huge fan following out of the gate on Deep Space Nine.
I myself remember not particularly caring for Bashir yeah. in this episode, and it actually took me a long time to get around Bashir until I kind of realized, I don't know, he turned into a good character very slowly. He actually turned into one of my favorite characters, and he started off as my least favorite.
Right.
So I remember watching this at the time and thinking, like, really? That's who they chose to put on? So if you were making the argument, Cam, as you were just a moment ago, that this is not maybe the best way to get on the hype train of Deep Space Nine, I would say as a contemporary viewer at the time, I would agree with that, yes.
I do wonder if it did any good, if it really contributed anything. Because, I mean, yeah. a lot of the reason for a crossover is to try and get eyeballs on both series, essentially. But you can really market this and hype it. And then hopefully they're trying to get people to jump to Deep Space Nine as well. And I don't know that this was a way that would really make people who are maybe just sole TNG watchers at this point being like, I got to watch this Deep Space Nine and see what this Bashir character's doing.
Well, and even for our own argument that we're having here, I wonder if his appearance justifies itself and that we get something substantial out of it that maybe we couldn't have gotten from some other character or else even some other character on TNG. Could
yeah.
Geordi have not had this storyline going on with Data?
Right.
That's why I thought it's fine.
Yeah.
But I'm not quite sure if it justifies itself the same way that Emissary does as a crossover episode.
And I think part of the reason it doesn't justify itself as well is the fact that he was interchangeable with Dax to a certain degree. I mean, they wanted Dax. It's like, oh, can't get her. Here's Bashir. So then it's like...
They had the same blue uniform. They're like, you better...
it was the exact same uniform.
Exactly, yeah.
And, you know, so it's not like they had a really, like, passionate Bashir story. They were like, this is a character we want to tell this story through. It was like, oh, Terry Farrell's busy? Okay. You know, Sadig Al-Fadel, get the suit on.
Yeah.
You're going in.
Got it. Okay. So let's jump from TNG back over to Deep Space Nine. And actually, no. I apologize. I'm getting them all mixed up, Cam, because they're all crossover episodes. Let's stick on the TNG train here and talk about Firstborn.
Right.
Not the greatest outing. It features the Duras sisters, and their Enterprise D is on a hunt for the Duras sisters, and so Riker has to call Quark on the view screen.
Right.
Do you know where the Duras sisters are, Quark? And it's really much, pretty much just like Quark's efforts to get Riker to give up the vouchers that Quark gave him at his bar instead of the gold press latinum that he earned on the Dabo table.
Right.
So I would say it...
gold.
Press latinum.
Yeah.
To me, it seemed like a cheap marketing ploy, and
right.
I came away from that scene thinking, like, did it really add anything to the TNG adventure? I would say no, not really, but the thing is, I think Quark quickly became extremely iconic within Star Trek fandom. like one of the most recognizable characters. Even if you weren't a fan of Star Trek period, I think you saw that alien and you identified him as Quark. Like he was appearing on like Time Magazine in Hawaiian, not Time Magazine.
Man of the Year.
he was on TV Guide in like a Hawaiian t-shirt. Sure. You know, and people were like, whoa, yeah, we know this guy.
The famous Regis and Kathy Lee video. Yeah.
Extremely famous. It's in the Smithsonian. So I think it works as like a marketing ploy, but as a scene that gives me much of anything, I'd say, no, we already know that Quark likes greed and will do anything he can to get out of owing anybody anything. It doesn't tell me anything I did not already know about Quark. It makes Riker look like a pretty suave, like, gambler, though.
That ain't hard, though.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, what does this scene really do for marketing, though? Like, do you think that it's a scene that would ever excite someone about the Deep Space Nine show?
I don't even think this scene was featured in those, like, previews or anything like that. I don't know what is really meant to do. Like I said, it just seemed kind of a cheap way to advertise DS9.
But
using...
does it then just become fan service? Because only, you know, the fans who are watching both shows would be like, oh, wow, it's Quark. Someone who's not watching Deep Space Nine isn't going to be like, oh, man. But what a great scene.
Here's the weird thing, though, is like that's not an era where you'd ever do fan service like that. They wouldn't care. Yeah.
No,
so
it's true.
I'll say the series that I thought, or not at all following those CW shows in which...
Don't lie, Tyler.
No, but you know, I do
the
know...
The posters are all over the walls here.
I do know those CW shows, every single episode is like pretty much a crossover episode with all the other adventures. But before that, I did follow Buffy and Angel, and they actually made sure they justified all the crossover episodes that they would have as those would air. It made a lot of sense to me. This one, I don't really know what they were thinking with Quark's appearance.
I don't know. Like, I look at sort of the history of crossovers, and you see a lot of really big ones in the past. It's not like crossovers have changed so much since the Berman era went off the air that crossovers have completely redefined themselves. But you look back in like the 60s when you've got like Batman teaming up with Green Hornet and stuff like that. You know, it's like these were big events. Or you had the Flintstones and the Jetsons meeting up in like a TV movie. It seems like it would actually benefit them to do something a little splashier than just throwing in Quark or Bashir.
Yeah.
You know, like, why not really have... I mean, I guess it becomes tough to juggle two crews.
Do you know what it is, though? It's that all comes down to what they want to do is syndication.
That's true, yeah.
And that it's just
what about a standalone thing, though?
No, it's just economics, though. That's what the thought process was at the time. If they launched another Star Trek spinoff that took place within the same time frame as Discovery, or maybe involving time travel, it took place in a different time frame?
Sure.
I could see them totally, you know, buying into this new crossover era of television. But just at the time, I mean, that's not how TV was really done. So,
yeah.
Unless you're Xena and Hercules. Yeah. So,
yeah.
What's that a reference to?
That was Xena.
I know. It's just joking. Speaking of Quark, let's jump over to Caretaker, the premiere episode of Star Trek Voyager.
Right.
I like how we get to have kind of Quark is kind of a base for a lot of these crossovers here. But of course, we meet him with Harry Kim. He's trying to swindle Harry Kim, make him guilt him into buying some crap, like little gems that like are worthless.
Yeah.
And
was Harry Kim going to do with these gems?
He was guilted into them because he told Quark, like, we were warned about Ferengi at the Academy. And Quark was like, "You were warned? That's racist. I want your name. I want the name of the instructor who warned you about us." And Harry's like, "Oh, no. I'll buy something from you." Tom walks in. And this is kind of the, you see Tom in his uniform for the first time. And like, he's taking Harry under his wing. It's kind of a scene that actually sets the stage for the character dynamic between those two that actually lasts throughout the rest of the series, which I do think is interesting. So,
yeah.
And Quark is being Quark in this one, though. Like, I don't view it and say, oh, it's like Brandon Braga writing for Quark. It's like the Michael Piller script here. Yeah. So I like this scene. It makes sense within the context of Deep Space Nine as well as Voyager.
It is interesting, though, that you see, as you've said, like the Quark emerging as this iconic Deep Space Nine character who shows up in TNG and Voyager, and then, of course, cut scene for allegedly from Star Trek Insurrection. is he the Coulson of the Berman era of Star Trek?
He might just be, yeah. I hope he stays away from big staffs.
No kidding. So this very much worked for you.
Yeah. You know, it fits within the contemporary context of each respective series. The characters are true to themselves and actually tells us something notable about the characters.
Yeah. I really like how it does show that Harry Kim is very naive and a little easier to push around versus like Tom Paris, who's kind of the know-it-all guy.
He's been around the block.
Yeah. He's seen it all. Doesn't look like he has, but he's seen it all. And it establishes these two characters just through a fun scene with Quark. And I think that's the best way to do it versus Quark just kind of hamming it up as like the scene with Riker.
Yeah. Well, it also brings me back to the aesthetics of this because we also have Voyager docked on the pylons.
I love scenes like this.
It's very cool. And you also see kind of the size difference between Voyager and the Enterprise as well, just with respect to when they're respectively docked on the pylons. And I'm like, it makes the universe feel that much more real versus, I don't know, beat up in ops and saying, yeah, Voyager's docked.
Yeah.
And then you just see people coming through the airlock. You're like, oh, okay.
Right.
So, yeah, this one totally works for me. I'm down with this.
Yeah, going off of this trend of baton passing at the start of a series, I think this was a smart one. Do you think there would have been another option that would have been interesting to see?
On Voyager?
Yeah.
Would have been, well, I think the closest we got was False Prophets, in which we had the Ferengi that went through the Barzan wormhole back in TNG.
They
reappeared in the Delta Quadrant.
Yeah.
And I guess we had the Borg Queen show up, but these are, like I said, they're not crossover episodes. These are more character cameos.
Yeah, but I mean more for the debut episode, having another Deep Space Nine character to pass the baton. Is there another one that would have been interesting?
So you mean like excising Quark from the episode?
Like the Quark scene does not exist.
Right. I'm trying to, well, because the next option would have been like, you know, Sisko interacting with Janeway, but do they have an inherent conflict like the Sisko Picard dynamic? I would say no. So it feels as if you're trying to tread, you know, the same old ground without actually doing anything viable there. I would maybe suggest. Oh no, I know who. What about that faceless first officer interacting with Kira?
That would be amazing.
Yeah,
just amazing.
Okay. So why don't we stick on Star Trek Voyager? And we're going to go to an episode, I'll say the name of it, and maybe some listeners will think, oh, I know why he's bringing this one up, and it's not for the reasons you may think, but I want to talk about Death Wish. Mm. This, of course, is a first episode.
Charles Bronson.
Yeah. Bruce Willis. this is the first one to feature Q, and he had many number of appearances on Voyager. I don't consider any of those crossover episodes, because they're more like a character carrying over from another series after that series has come to an end. He was never a regular. But the reason why this is a crossover episode is because, one, William Riker, people may not remember this. I remember I was surprised when I rewatched this one again for our Q episode. Will Riker appears in this one quite prominently to vouch, well, or at least testify to Q's character within the context of this.
I had completely forgotten that Riker's in it. And then I'm like, why would I forget it? It's such like he's given great material.
Yeah.
It's not like it's just like a pop in, pop out moment. I don't know. It's weird because I think this is actually a really good one.
The thing that kind of kills it for me to a certain degree, though, is that they wipe Riker's memory at the end of it.
Sure.
And I was like, that's kind of stupid. Because then it means
like,
it doesn't.
What's the worst that happens, but having him have the memory?
Well, I think their debate was we don't want to interfere with the normal course of the universe, and this would alert Starfleet to the fact that Voyager is out there. And I think that
would
sap some of the tension from the series. No, Voyager would be like, oh, there's hope. Maybe they're mounting a mission to look for us.
Right. Maybe it would just speed up the Pathfinder project.
They're very possible. But it seems almost kind of cruel, you know, for, you know, Q to play this trick. But, Riker, I used the word suave earlier, but Riker's just very suave in this. It's always delightful to see him. I wasn't really expecting this back. Although, I do seem to recall he was in the previews for this as well as Q. So I think it's a pretty stacked episode if you're bringing in John Delancey as well as Jonathan Frakes.
It is interesting to me that, you know, Jonathan Frakes becomes a character who they really want to have pop up further down the road a lot. And there was a lot of talk how I know that if Nimoy had not come into the 2009 Star Trek film, there was talk about having Jonathan Frakes come in as Riker.
No, he would have still been playing Spock. It would have been kind of awkward.
With the beard.
With the beard.
Yeah. Like, is this a Mirror Universe thing? Like, what is going on?
But he would have had a bowl cut.
This would have been...
And no ears. People would have been like, this is the weirdest Spock I can recall.
That would have been incredible. And having scenes of him facing Zach Quinto being like...
High fives?
It's just like, live long and prosper.
Yeah.
That would have been incredible. But it is interesting to me that, you know, in when they're putting that movie together in 2007, 2008, that they are looking at Jonathan Frakes as the character you would bring in. Like, it's interesting they weren't like, we're going to make a hard sell to get, you know, Patrick Stewart in there or something. Like, Jonathan Frakes was their second choice.
Well, I wonder why.
What
that...
about Chekhov?
Yeah, right. I wonder why that was, though. Well, was it because they wanted that? I think the reason why is because they wanted that first officer dynamic.
Sure.
Which make, like, you have to kind of support the captain. Because I think, honestly, Patrick Stewart would have been a better catch, more recognizable star for the mainstream audiences.
I remember reading that story. When I read that story, I was surprised that that was their next choice.
Yeah. But I think thematically it would have made more sense, personally. But with regards to Death Wish... I feel mixed on this one, though. It's
Hold on. What would they have done in Star Trek Into Darkness when they're dealing with Khan? Riker shows up on the view screen. He's like, well, according to my research, he's a bad guy.
Yeah, he would be like, I've never met anyone more dangerous. So, thanks. What would the character's name have been among the fan community? Yeah, if you have to combine Riker and Spock. Spocker?
Rock.
I like Spocker.
Yeah, that works.
Okay, but Death Wish, does this just this adventure with Riker popping in, getting his memory wiped so that it all kind of amounts to nothing,
right.
Does it justify the appearance, though?
Well, that's a good question, because the fact that you're wiping his memory takes away any sort of long-term effect. That, you know, it doesn't really change anything for Riker. It doesn't contribute to his journey or anything like that. He has no memory of it. So it is a little bit of a stunt.
Yeah.
And so the episode is really good, and I think what he contributes to it makes it very entertaining. I can totally see how fans would love it. But I don't know that it quite justifies itself as a momentous Riker moment because of the fact it is very disposable for that character.
You and I could not even remember that it was in there. Yeah. It took us both by surprise. So I would say the fact that we forgot about it initially.
Yeah.
It kind of tells you, yeah, it's...
But, like, what do you make of one where it's written really well and gives the character, like, really great scenes, but is ultimately has no long-term impact?
Then I say it goes back to a marketing ploy.
Yeah.
So I think that's what it comes down to. So, all right, well, why don't we jump over to one... I'll just come out and say this, but we're going to talk about Trials and Tribulations.
Yeah.
Can we just say it up front? This one justifies itself as a crossover episode.
No, I totally disagree. Yeah, this is one of the greats.
Yeah. And so what is it about it then that makes it so exceptional? Is it the fact that, I mean, you can make the argument, well, it's super fan servicey, they're touching all the buttons, but I think the storyline actually means something. There's actually tension going on, which you'd be kind of remiss to find in some of these other episodes, though.
What I really love about this episode is that they take... a very well-known, tightly structured story in The Trouble with Tribbles. We know what happens with The Trouble with Tribbles. Like, there's not a lot to expand on. At least you would look at it that way if you're going and being like, what's our crossover with that episode? And somehow they spin an entirely new story out of it that is satisfying it for all its own individual merits, while also completely reveling in totally, like, accurate TOS aesthetics. But it's still a satisfying DS9 story and a satisfying TOS story.
Yeah.
It's like a master class in how to do this sort of thing.
Well, it goes back to the fact that, okay, look, you got the fan service-y stuff where they're forced gumping half the cast into this adventure.
Yeah.
But I also just like how they make the adventure add up into something more where you even have like Dax tossing that one tribble and it's that iconic tribble that rolls out and hits Kirk one last time.
Yeah.
There's just that brawl that takes place. And then we have the DS9 crew getting a talking to from Kirk in this context. And let's be honest, Sisko actually succumbing to the total desire on his part to go get the quote-unquote autograph from Kirk,
right.
You buy that. He is being the fan for that moment.
And we never see Sisko like that on the show. We never see him have these like kind of giddy moments, other than maybe some of the early romance stuff with Cassidy Yates, you know, where you see him a little more, you know, kind of giggly. But you don't get to see Sisko have these light moments of character that kind of reveal what makes him an engaging human being outside of being like a really great strategic mind.
So then I think that actually adds up to kind of how this justifies itself from a character basis as well. It's not just a great solid sci-fi adventure that takes place within the contemporary context, but it is like a solid like character dynamics going on between everybody here. We even get like those iconic things that all the fans know about where Worf says when the Klingons are spotted, we do not discuss this with outsiders, referring, of course, to the different look of the Klingons.
Yes, definitely.
I mean, Arn Darvin, he even sets up all this spy stuff that's going to be going on in Discovery as well. So it's weird how this one has, I think, just gripped audiences in a way that Deep Space Nine, I think for mainstream audiences, really did that.
Yeah.
But I remember watching this one, and my mom, who she saw a little bit of the original series growing up because my grandma was a big TOS fan.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I think, first and only time my mom ever sat down for a Deep Space Nine episode. Like, she was genuinely curious about what this was. People were talking about this back in, I think it was 96. Yeah, it was 96 for the 30th anniversary. So this is a big deal.
And you cite that moment where Dax throws out the Tribble and whatever. That is a moment that now when I watch The Trouble with Tribbles, that pops into my head that this is going on at the time I'm watching this episode.
Dax is in the compartment.
Yes. Like, it actually changes how you watch The Trouble with Tribbles.
Yeah.
And I think that is absolutely amazing. And I mean, it's the sort of thing that's so easy to take for granted and just be like, yeah, that was a really good technical job on the part of the writers. You know, they did a really great job mashing up all that footage and everything. But to somehow have an effect on an episode that was like 30 years earlier and is iconic and beloved and changes the way you watch it, to me, is really a testament to just what a great hour of television this is.
Yeah, so, and I think that's a testament also to the directing.
Yeah.
And like, you believe it, that you are in this crossover universe. And, you know, as much as people would, I guess, you know, roll their eyes at how different the aesthetics are on Discovery now.
Sure.
I think they kind of show that you, in A Mirror Darkly as well, kind of showed that contemporary audiences, they could have bought something similar to those aesthetics that we saw way back when. But
yeah.
I don't know. This is just such a great adventure.
And I just love how unassuming it is. It's just a fun episode. It's not trying to be this epic, like, you must watch this hour of television.
Right.
You know, it's just like we're having a good time. And somehow this episode has just lasted for, you know, just because fans love it.
It's also funny, like, how much stark contrast this stands in versus Emissary, which that was a very heavy crossover adventure versus. So Sisko's interacted with Kirk and he's interacted with Picard. Which captain of the Enterprise do you think he likes more?
Oh, I think Kirk, just by a little bit.
Just by a little? Just by his reaction?
Yeah.
Okay.
How do you think Picard would have reacted like in that moment? Do you think, because you know, we saw obviously he meets Kirk in Generations, but do you think, you know, if he'd had an adventure like this in the, say, you know, the early seasons of TNG, do you think they would have written it differently to make him a little more geeky?
So Sisko seems to be kind of the most buttoned down of all the captains.
Yeah.
Even more so than Picard, even though I think
Captain's holiday, man.
Well, but we see Sisko more vulnerable in his home life. He does let loose with somebody like Jake. You see that in an episode like Explorers. But I think kind of the scene with Sisko geeking out with Kirk, I think that was more surprising than it would have been with Picard geeking out at Kirk. I would expect Picard to do that as maybe the historian or what have you.
Sure.
So I think the Sisko scene took me by more surprise than it would have otherwise.
Interesting.
Yeah. So.
And we should also just say Jadzia in the world of TOS is just amazing.
You know what? Her talking about how handsome that commanding officer was, and Sisko's like, Kirk was known as a ladies' man. Oh, I was talking about Spock.
Yes.
And it's like, that's one of the best like exchanges throughout Deep Space Nine.
It's great stuff. And it completely spoiled, I think, a lot of viewers for like what these crossovers could be going forward.
Yeah.
Because I don't know that they've ever touched that again.
Although, is the low point where Bashir's debating whether to sleep with his grandma?
Oh, Bashir.
That was a weird one. Yeah. Actually, no. One of the other best points was when O'Brien saw the random red shirt and thought it was Kirk.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
I think that was actually the actor who played Kirk's stunt double, which is even funnier.
How old would he have been at that point?
He looked pretty old, though, and like kind of like...
So he would probably be in his 50s at that point, right?
The stuntman?
Yeah.
Perhaps. Yeah. I don't know. But he was a little heftier than Kirk as well, so it's just kind of right. funny that that's who they picked as kind of a joke, if I do recall the story correctly. But
well, yeah. If you go to those early episodes of TOS where they do the Kirk swap during the fight scenes,
the editing was not so great back then. Yeah,
too many Jellikers.
Yeah. So why don't we stick around with the same week that this aired, Flashback.
Mm-hmm.
This is on Star Trek Voyager. This is their way of honoring the 30th anniversary of Star Trek. And
what
of course,
a fun idea. Like, why can't something like this happen again? I mean, you'll never have the amount of Star Trek shows on the air at the same time.
I know.
Do this thing? But man, what a blast. It reminds me of in the 90s, they had for, I think it was Spider-Man's 30th anniversary, all the different Spider-Man titles had different hologram covers.
Okay.
And it was so exciting, and I remember buying them all.
How much did you spend?
Back then, comics weren't that expensive. They're probably like $3.99 each.
Okay.
So whatever, I paid, you know, I don't know, $15.
Yeah. Sure.
But, you know, this kind of goes hand in hand with that. Like these kind of big splashy celebrations of anniversaries. And yeah.
Meanwhile, the 50th anniversary of Star Trek Cam.
Not so flashy.
Was there a celebration? I don't recall.
Maybe a comic got a holographic cover somewhere. But yeah, definitely not on the air.
So with Flashback, we have Tuvok. He kind of succumbs to like this neurovirus, and he's flashing back to his adventure that takes place within the contemporary context of Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
You're
where
forgetting what the trigger is, though.
Isn't it a cave?
It's him dropping a little girl off a cliff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you could play a drinking game. Every time you watch that girl fall off a cliff, take a shot, you would not be alive by the end.
Sure, sure.
Nor was she.
That's true.
Yeah. But
so anyways, what we're talking about here is the scenes aboard the Excelsior with Tuvok. He's kind of really deciding what he wants to do with his career.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll say as an adventure that affects what happens in the Undiscovered Country, not quite the same as what we saw with Trials and Tribulations, but I think it does tell you a little something about Tuvok's character. So
right.
I would say, yes, this does justify itself.
I don't know that it makes Tuvok that much more likable.
No.
But it does give some context as to, you know, how he wasn't ready for Starfleet and how he ended up leaving for 50 years and raising kids and all that sort of
thing. Which I kind of like that we don't really see that often portrayed on Star Trek. We've got, you know, Sisko very much, you know, prioritizing his fatherhood.
Yeah.
I like the fact that you have a character like Tuvok who did the same thing. And it's like, look, I need to take a break and go back when I've got a long life ahead of me.
Right.
I can take a 50-year hiatus.
I mean, not so much the fatherhood aspect, but you do see with like Wesley Crusher, a character who's like, you know what, Starfleet's not for me.
Yeah.
And leaves and then comes back.
Apparently. So. Yeah. Listen to our last week's episode for us to dive even deeper into that conundrum there.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but with regards to Flashback, I'll say the fact that it aired the same time that Trials and Tribulations was, it really, as a contemporary viewer at the time, it really paled in comparison. And I think that really kind of dragged down its reputation among a lot of fans there. Like, Deep Space Nine goes all out, and, Voyager hires George Takei. And it's kind of like, well...
You know, I always felt like moving Sulu to his own ship was sort of like one of those movie things where you're like, okay, well, that's kind of fun. But it also removes this character from the action.
Yeah.
I did enjoy, in Flashback, getting to spend a little bit of time on Sulu's ship just for what it adds to that character.
Okay.
And seeing Rand on the ship as well. Like, I actually really enjoy that sort of stuff. I liked seeing how Sulu carries himself as a captain and dealing with, like, Tuvok questioning his orders. Moments like that add a lot to that episode. I think what actually holds Flashback back from being, I think, a really great episode is the whole what gets us there. It's really takes quite a while to get there. We're watching this little girl get dropped off a cliff over and over again. And all the whole kind of mind meld science and the doctor and Kes at the computer monitors being like, oh my God, the brain waves are going this way and that, you know, it's just not that interesting. Whereas the Trial and Tribulations one works because it's set up in such a clever, poppy way where it's fun to go on this caper with these characters. This isn't a caper. This is like, we're going to make a mind meld. Like, that's just not a particularly interesting way to do it.
Yeah, I agree. But despite the very valid criticisms, I would say this does justify itself as a crossover.
I think entirely. I think the crossover aspects of the episode are really, really good.
Yeah.
I think it's the stuff kind of that frames the crossover that might be a little bit, you know, it doesn't hold up great for rewatches.
I would say, yeah, the framing of it is not nearly as strong as it was in, say, Trials and Tribulations,
right,
where you're using a far more interesting framing device, which is, kind of, was it the Orb of Time that Arndt Darvin got his hands on? Like, just that kind of fun stuff.
Yeah.
So, anyways.
I do think Flashback justifies itself, I should say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why don't we jump over to These Are the Voyages, fan favorite
completely
episode.
Justified.
Yeah. this is really not so much a TNG crossover as much as it is an Enterprise crossover on TNG, which is
right.
I feel for fans who are watching this and they're like, this is the finale to Enterprise, where of course Troy and Riker, they end up on the holodeck observing a big mission from the NX-01 crew before, you know, the Federation's official.
Yeah.
And we get to watch the death of Tucker for no apparent reason.
Space pirates.
Space pirates,
yep.
Who had zero connection to his narrative arc. Anyway.
There must have been another solution to that.
No, you know what it was? Well, yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Feels so lazy.
I think that's what it was. They wanted to make stakes to this episode, but why couldn't they bring back, like, I don't know, Future Guy to kill him? Or it's just something that had some sort of meaning to the episode. But as a crossover adventure, this seems awkward. This seems more like Star Trek karaoke, like somebody doing their best impression of Star Trek. And it takes place within Pegasus, the context of Pegasus,
which I think is a terrible idea.
We'll explain that.
Well, because I think I remember them really marketing Enterprise a lot to fans and being like, this isn't like the other Star Trek series. You should be watching this. And so let's assume it does pick up new viewers who don't watch other Star Trek episodes. This is baffling. And in fact, I watched this episode before I saw Pegasus. I'm one of the few out there.
and you're just kind of going, huh?
Yeah, I was like, what is going on? Like, they were not speaking about the Pegasus story in ways that were specific enough to understand what they're talking about. They're leaving it vague so that they don't confuse people. But by doing that, it makes it just feel clunky and weird.
But it was just Riker saying, like, I've got a hard decision to make.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean? This felt like, to me, the types of bad, like, sitcom crossovers you would see in, like, TGIF.
Yeah. So they go on the holodeck here, and so that's the framing device. I think this is an even worse framing device than Flashback, in which you're watching a holodeck adventure. You're not actually seeing the physical crew that you've been invested in for the last four seasons, and I think that is really cheap as well. And you also watch, you feel as if you're watching something apocryphal, in that maybe history got it wrong to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And so how much can we actually trust the holodeck? So it really takes away so much out of everything. And it makes the final episode a Riker story. And I'm like, as much as I like seeing Jonathan Frakes pop up, he was popping up on DS9 as Tom Riker, Voyager and Death Wish, and of course Enterprise. Like, he's all over the place. I really, really not like seeing Riker in this episode.
Well, it doesn't add anything to the story of the Pegasus, like that character's journey in that episode.
That episode was fine without this little kind of ancillary adventure here.
It feels insulting in terms of its placement within the series. And then you also just question, like, okay, just from the point of view of an adult, who's, how old is Riker at this point, do you think? 35, maybe?
Maybe a little older.
Yeah. I mean, he's obviously older when they shot this episode, but within the placement of TNG, we'll say he's 35.
Yeah, yeah.
What is this 35-year-old doing? Like, just think about this. How much time is he spending? He's, like, chopping carrots?
42 minutes, Cam.
But this looks like it's a significant span of time on the NX-01.
It does. Like, he's going into Holodeck 3 multiple times.
Like, what is he doing?
he's obviously not all that concerned about Admiral Pressman.
Is no one like, hey, where's Riker?
No, remember, Data is.
That's true.
Data had a great voice cameo like that was actually legitimately good, but
it is so weird that I just cannot quite wrap my head around it.
Is this the worst crossover episode, Cam?
I think it probably is, because it's insulting to both series.
Yeah. So could we make an argument that this is the worst? Can we say that Trials and Tribulations is the best?
I think okay. We can say that. Now, do you think that this episode, not the way this episode is written, not the plot of this episode, but the idea of Riker and Troy on the holodeck seeing the NX-01 could have worked for just like a, maybe like a sweeps episode somewhere within the rest of the series?
As long as it didn't feature the death of Tucker?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Different script.
Yeah, I still would think it'd go down as a pretty weird episode. Yeah. But it wouldn't go down as a disgraceful episode the way that it is. Like, Brandon Braga literally goes to conventions, and every single year somebody goes up to the microphone and complains to him about the finale, and all he can do is apologize for it. I don't know why Brandon Braga keeps going.
And Threshold.
Yeah. I don't think he should apologize for Threshold.
Though. I would own Threshold.
Yeah. But, you know, it's just unfortunate here.
Yeah.
So.
And it was just a really ugly way to end that series.
Yeah. Ugh. Are you talking about the scar on Tucker's face? Ouch. But let's talk about Generations, because this is the ultimate kind of crossover adventure with regards to marketing, getting the crews together.
This has to be the most hyped one, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I can't think of anything bigger.
Otherwise, their marketing budget would have been kind of wasted here.
Right.
But, of course, we've got the... it starts off with the crew of the Enterprise. Not the cool crew, not the Spock, McCoy, Kirk trio. It's Chekhov, Scotty, and Kirk.
Yeah, that classic trio.
That classic trio.
From all those episodes you love.
And then...
Oh, the adventures those three went on.
I'm trying to think. I just saw, just watched Gamesters of Triskelion, and Chekhov was with Kirk.
Yeah.
And Chekhov actually went down on a lot of missions with Kirk.
Spectre of the Gun, I think all of those characters were present.
Yeah, what about, what's the Halloween episode? Catspaw. Anyway, sorry. So you start there, and then you leave to just Picard and Kirk on an adventure through the wilderness, like horseback riding and cracking eggs open. And then you end up on...
Fans are just like, this is everything I paid my dollars for.
But then finally you end up on this desert planet where you're trying to save another planet filled with people we've never even heard of, have zero connection to.
Right.
And I guess we know that, the saucer section has crash-landed on Viridian 3, so you're supposed to care because of the Enterprise crew. It's tough to be invested in any of these adventures that's going on here. And I recall Ron Moore saying that yesterday's Enterprise, that should have been the TNG debut film, not this kind of real piecemeal sort of like made out of a laundry list of studio demands kind of adventure that we got here.
I think the emotional journey of Picard works okay. You know, he's in a place where he's kind of questioning his choices and where they've taken him and what's going to be in the future. And so introducing Kirk in that aspect makes a lot of sense, because Kirk is obviously someone who had that Peter Pan complex and can kind of give some advice that might mean something to Picard at this point in his life. But I don't know that this was the type of story to do that. Like, I think you could have had the two of them interact in a way that would have been more satisfying, not just narratively, but also just for what fans want to see.
I absolutely agree. Like, the execution of this was not very well done. But I will say
they're riding horses and cooking eggs. I know. And it's like
chopping wood.
Yeah. And I have to imagine people were sitting there just like, okay, this isn't what I expected.
When is the action going to start?
Yeah, like when are they going to be on the bridge together? But they never are.
I'll say this, though. There was an exceptional moment, though, in which Kirk tells Picard, don't ever let them take the captain's seat away from you. And I think that is something that really did stick with Picard, you know? Yeah. And so I think that is a fantastic moment. I don't think that moment justifies this entire adventure, which is unfortunate because it's 110 minutes and I think like a $70 million budget.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I do like Kirk's death scene too, not the actual how he dies, but Picard just kind of being with him in his final moments. I think that scene is quite impactful. I just wish it had been tied to something more interesting than a villain that's kind of vaguely defined and not that interesting.
Do you think after this adventure, Sisko went up to Picard and said, I wish it was you?
That would have been something.
Yeah. Okay. So, Cam, so we've kind of wrapped up kind of the big crossover episodes. I want to briefly touch on Discovery because we ended up with the hint that we'll be having some sort of crossover adventure in season two after we saw the NCC 1701 pop up in the finale, the season finale of Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah.
Do you think that they're going to be able to justify this? Because, spoiler alerts, we have confirmation as of this week that Anson Mount has been cast as one Captain Pike, replacing, of course, Sean Kenny.
Yeah.
Who's still alive.
And really wanted the job.
Really wanted the job.
Yeah.
Anyways, look, we are going to get a bit of a crossover adventure. And I say that this does qualify as under our definition in that it takes place within the contemporary context of the series. We go back to an episode like The Menagerie, which, of course, is following the adventures of Pike and Dr. Boyce, my favorite.
Of course, Dr.
And,
Boyce.
And number one.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah. So are you looking forward, or do you think they could get themselves into a bit of a sticky situation with a crossover episode to kick off season two? Or a series of crossover episodes?
Right. I think this could work. I think what makes it, I think, a little more open than perhaps bringing in a character like Kirk, for example, is that you can do anything with Pike, really. You know, prime era Pike is just an open book, really. Yeah.
You know, he likes horses, too.
Loves the horses.
Yeah.
And cooking eggs, too.
Or does he?
I don't know.
I know he likes horses. Remember,
well, that's the thing. There's nothing to this character so far. They can add whatever they want.
But we do know he likes horses, because I think that's what he and Boyce were talking about as he's whining on his bed.
Yeah, exactly. Huh. But, you know, I am looking forward to seeing what they do with this character, because he's not super defined from the cage and the menagerie. And that's, you know, that's really all they have to go off of.
Yeah.
So I really think the sky's the limit for what they can do for this character.
I just hope the execution is well done.
Yeah.
I don't know what they're going to do with the uniform. I don't know what they're going to do with the 1960s sets.
Right.
It's going to be interesting.
I really can't wait to see what they do visually with that era of Star Trek.
Yeah. So, I'm looking forward to it. As much as that scene at the very end of the episode should have bugged me, because I'm a very prickly sort of viewer, I loved it. And it gave me so much hope for what season two could unleash on us viewers, that kind of optimism of Star Trek that I think we all want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I think this could work.
Now, we have a Pike cast. Do you think we're going to see the full crew that we know from the cage?
I think you have to give us number one.
Yes.
I think at the very least, you'll maybe get a holographic projection of Spock, you know, that of Leonard Nimoy as Spock.
Right.
That could work, because it could kind of justify why the...
That's a good idea, yeah.
Why the aesthetics of, I guess, just the cinematography don't exactly line up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think kind of the holographic projection of Spock would work in this context. But beyond that, I mean, who do you really need to cast? Like, you have Boyce, and you've got that...
If they do a big announcement for casting Dr. Boyce, I will be retweeting that like nobody's business.
Besides you and me.
Yeah.
Does anyone know who Dr. Boyce is?
Nope.
It's just like an in-joke that you and I have.
Yeah. Okay. He's the new Baral, I guess.
Yeah. So, look, I think they have to have number one. Absolutely.
It actually excites me more for them to meet these characters than if they were meeting, like, Kirk.
I would have more issues with that if, like, you know, it's 10 years later, or even if it's a Lieutenant Kirk on the Farragut, I'd be like, oh, why are we going down this road here?
It's like the kid from the 2009 movie.
All grown up?
Yeah.
My name is James Tiberius Kirk.
Do you think we're going to see that at some point?
I hope not.
I think we are.
You think
so? I think Kirk is going to show up at some point.
Are they going to get that guy from Star Trek Continues, the fan film series?
Who's like 55? Was it Vic Mignola or something?
Yeah. Vic Mignola.
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
That, I mean, I would be watching that episode on like a loop.
I think he's auditioning. I think he's submitting tapes to the producers, like earnestly trying to get cast in that.
That would be pretty great.
Yeah.
Okay. I support this 100%.
Okay.
Or just cast him as Dr. Boyce. I'll also be happy.
Alrighty. So, Cam, there's a couple episodes that maybe did not make it onto our list because they don't quite fit the definition. Why don't you take, there's one in particular that you wanted to bring up here.
One that I think is kind of interesting to just mention is Assignment Earth.
And how is this a crossover episode, Cam?
It's mashing up the universes of two different shows, just one show that doesn't quite exist yet. It's like a backdoor pilot.
For another Star Trek series?
No, it's a whole other series. It's another science fiction show that Gene Roddenberry...
Is a crossover episode to you?
Well, it's a Gene Roddenberry joint.
Okay.
And so you have the adventures of Gary Seven intermingling with the story of Kirk and Spock back on Earth in the 60s.
What do you mean, intermingling?
Taking over?
It's Kirk and Spock watching a monitor for 45 minutes.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
It is a fun one, though. Yeah, it's sort of an interesting curiosity. I don't think there's any other episode like it in the Star Trek history.
No.
And for that, it's sort of memorable.
Terry Garr is fantastic.
Yeah.
So.
And that weird cat lady?
Yeah.
What was that all about? We'll never know.
Never know. One that we should mention as well is Star Trek Nemesis. We do have Janeway.
Mm-hmm.
She kind of pops up as an admiral, so we kind of know what happens to Janeway post Endgame.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. And there's some other ones that we were kind of like, well, are the fans going to, fans of the series, not fans of our show, of course.
Yeah.
But are listeners going to be upset that we don't bring up, say, Reg Barkley or Q from all their adventures on Voyager? And I don't think they quite qualify as crossovers. It's more like, you know, like recurring characters just kind of popping up for an adventure that takes place outside of the contemporary context from which they're best known. So that's why... Yeah. We didn't really dive into those.
There's also the weird one of Q and Vash showing up
on
DS9
yeah.
and basically ending the story of Cupid, which, very odd choice.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can hear more about that one in our Q episode.
Yeah. It's a fun episode that we did there, so I'd recommend that. The last one that I'll kind of highlight here is Timeless, which featured Geordi LaForge.
Yeah.
But it was kind of an alt-universe Geordi LaForge on Voyager, in which he's a captain in the Alpha Quadrant, and he's interacting with Chakotay and Harry Kim over a viewer.
Right.
I think that's, again, just kind of a cheap marketing play. I think LeVar Burton may have even directed this episode, if I recall correctly. So, but again, it doesn't take place within the contemporary context of the episode. I know I keep going back to that, so that's why I wouldn't necessarily dive too deeply into this one.
It's interesting to me that Geordi was not a character who was used more for crossovers, because he's such an iconic look.
Yeah, I know. But do you think, you know, LeVar Burton ruined it for himself by getting rid of the visor and going with the ocular implants in First Contact onward?
It's quite possible.
Because this was a LeVar Burton-like decision.
Yeah.
So he was sick of that visor. I think everybody else was... Do you think LeVar Burton would have been getting more screen time if he kept the visor on throughout the movies? He had a fair amount of screen time in Generations.
Yeah, probably.
Every subsequent movie, he got less and less.
Yeah, it's true.
He certainly would have sold more toys.
Now, before we wrap up, I just wanted to give my thoughts on the new IDW annual, the Star Trek Discovery story, which just hit shelves, and it's a double-sized story about Stamets. And I was really interested to read this because I felt like their Kalis stories have been pretty weak. They're just kind of bland prequel stuff. Not terrible, but kind of unmemorable. And so I wanted this single expanded story just to see what it was. And so I burned through it today. And this is a very confusing tie-in. Like, the Discovery is not proving to me to be a particularly valuable comic property in that they are just doing prequel stuff.
Is it stuff that essentially it ultimately adds up to nothing? Like, there's no stakes. It doesn't really matter.
The gist of the story is it's about Stamets doing research on spores, discovering the mycelial network, and then going to Discovery.
Okay.
And along the way, he meets Culber.
Does this seem more like kind of fan fiction, but like with the CBS stamp on it?
Yeah. It does, in that it's actually adding really nothing to my understanding. Yeah. I mean, we get a little bit of stuff between him and his partner on the project, and his partner's the one who ends up, I believe, on the Hood.
Oh, no.
What was it called?
The Glen.
The Glen, thank you. Who winds up on the Glen and has, you know, the tragic ending. But this is the sort of material that, to me, is so boxed in by what the show wants to do. Like, it's not opening up any avenues for them to kind of tell interesting stories.
I think that's the problem with them saying that this is kind of semi-canon.
Yeah.
So then you can't get these wild adventures. All you can get are, like, these bland kind of stories. Like you said, kind of boxed in here.
Yeah. And there's some, you know, like, kind of fun little fan geek moments in that it's like that, you know, Stamets was instrumental in getting Tilly on the ship. stuff like that, you're like, oh, that's kind of cute, whatever. Okay. But there's nothing about it that's valuable or nothing that's fun. Like, I look at the other Star Trek series that, you know, produced comic stories, like, you know, TNG or TOS specifically. And the types of stories they would have would just be like their adventures. Like, tell us the story of an adventure and an alien race they dealt with. And they could have stakes. They could have some sort of consequences to the story tied to the actual adventure itself.
Yeah.
Versus reading a story about Stamets doing research on spores.
Yeah.
Because you know where it's going.
Oh, Cam, I'm not even going to borrow your edition of this. I'm just going to...
And I will say, like, it's kind of like the Kayla stuff. It's not offensive. It's just kind of like there.
Yeah.
But like this issue cost me $11.
Really?
Yeah. And so does it justify paying $11 for? No. Like, yeah. And I think I'm, you know, I'll talk about the next episode, the final episode of the Kayla arc. But I think at that point I'm out. Just yeah. Because this property seems so boxed in by the continuity of the show and just the secrecy surrounding the show and how it is so plot based and you know, serialization based that there's just no room to have fun.
All right. Okay. So, well, I'm glad I did not continue after issue number one of that Kalis arc there. I was kind of like, it's on my bookshelf, but it's not going to be opened up anytime soon once again.
Yeah, so. I just thought when they announced they were going to do a standalone Stamets story, I thought, oh, there's so much space to kind of do something there. And they don't. It's kind of like one of those stories that takes place like 10 minutes before the first episode, yeah. You know, or it feels like that, where it's like, okay, really? There's nothing you could have done like 10 years before or something?
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay, so on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. We'll have a video up this week as usual, as well as more discussion about this week's podcast episode. Now, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
We are going to be talking about Star Trek's Darkest Hours, those shades of gray, not the horrible William Riker episode.
Darkest? You mean like the episode Night?
Not necessarily. I would say
with low lighting, right? So we're gonna talk about Generations more.
That's very possible. But I would say these are things where we get into a little bit of moral compromise with the characters. We go down these paths that we're very unsure of, and they kind of leave viewers feeling a little bit uncomfortable. And I think it's interesting when Star Trek goes into that particular area and how much it kind of rattles our expectations as viewers, who are obviously fans of a very optimistic view of humanity. So what happens when you get the opposite of that to a certain degree? And what does it reveal about us as viewers as well as the characters that we're so invested in? So that's going to be an interesting one there.
I can't wait to narrow down my DS9 picks.
yeah, I'm having that very issue, but I've got 7 days to figure it out. So,
yes, okay. Yeah. You can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vic Mignola Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in no more comics for Cam.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.